free. Has anything changed now? Sweet liberty.
Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here tonight on Sweet Liberty. This being Wednesday, the 31st of January in the year 2007. Isn't it amazing? Tomorrow's full moon. So if you feel weird or people are acting weird around you, just know that this too shall pass. Our spiritual message this evening is from the New Testament, John 18. You've heard it before. We've said it before, but I think it needs to be said over and over and over again because of the brainwashing that has taken place and instilled itself, I guess you would say, into our minds, the lies that have been told by the organized church. This is in John 18, and Jesus was talking to Pontius Pilate. And Pilate said to Jesus, "Are you a king then?" This is in verse 37. And Jesus said, "You say that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. To this cause, to this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth hears my voice." And I think that's important for us to remember, because we were told as we were growing up, and all of those of us who were raised in the brand name religions, doesn't matter which one it is, that Jesus came here solely to, quote, die for our sins. That isn't what he said. He said, "I came to bear witness unto the truth. To this end was I born. For this cause I came into the world, to bear witness unto the truth." Jesus said that as we sow, so shall we reap. And that would be quite a contradiction, wouldn't it? Saying that we will reap what we sow and then turn around and say, "Well, I came here to shed my blood for you, to, you know, so that all your, quote, sins will be washed away or covered," whatever, however you choose to hear it or believe it or see it. And I see that as a, what a cop-out, folks, you think about it. I mean, I know this because I've been searching all my life that I can ever remember, my earliest memories. But I remember talking to my schoolmates and asking them, "Well, what is your religion and what are your beliefs?" And da-da-da. And for the most part, it was, you know, that I'm going to heaven because I believe in Jesus and I believe that his blood, you know, was shed for my sins and I'm forgiven. And as long as I say that, and it doesn't matter what I do. And I've had people tell me, "Well, the Lord knows that I'm a weak sinner. I'm just a weak sinner, and he forgives me." Well, I say that if we can remember that statement uttered, allegedly uttered by Jesus in the red, in the New Testament, that he came into this world to bear witness unto the truth. He told us that as we sow, so shall we reap. And what that does is it brings the responsibility back unto us, doesn't it? Or the wrongs that we commit, whatever it is. Whatever it is. And he did give us a beautiful blueprint, I call it, for living. When they asked him, No, I was thinking of another one when they asked him what was the greatest commandment. And he said, love your Father, Creator, with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. He didn't say, don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. The greatest commandment is that we love one another, and we love our Heavenly Father with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. And he also said to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. That is a beautiful rule to live by, isn't it? And it doesn't say, oh, well, here I am. I'm going to die soon. My blood's going to be shed. I'm going to get hung up on a cross, and all your sins are going to be forgiven. No, he said, I came here to bear witness unto the truth. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to pick up where we left off last night. Folks, I was reading to you from chapter 25 of the book Jewish Persecution. 24 isn't done, but we're going to skip over that. I'm going to have 25 posted because it is important, because it's about the money, the monetary, the economic system. And I think it's important that people understand, at least have an idea of what's going on. So where we left off, I had digressed a little bit talking about the people, the genocide that has been committed down through the ages on the inhumanity of man to his brother. And the statement, one line, when talking about the millions, hundreds, millions that have been killed, slaughtered over the years. And the last statement was that to Jesus, one individual is precious, one soul. And I'm going to repeat a little bit of the beginning of the last half of this in case you weren't here, just to refresh you. Excuse me. I said we have, most of us, lived our lives believing that Adolf Hitler was the devil. What did he do that brought such powerful wrath down upon himself and the people of Germany? He did the same thing Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, and John Kennedy did after the money masters put him in power, if they did. And it seems that there is proof that they did. He kicked them out of Germany and created a debt-free government-issued script. Debt-free, not gold-backed, because the gold had left the country before Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. And to add insult to injury, he created trade agreements with other nations based on the barter system, bypassing the money masters. None of those trading nations were piling up debt or trade deficits. They traded wealth for wealth based on the production of the people. Let's back up for a moment, back to the beginning, where we quoted from a radio address by then U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull that was May 18, 1941. That was in May of 41, before the U.S. got into the war, folks. And he alludes to the dreaded economic program of Germany implemented by Adolf Hitler. He said that, this is quoting from the book Voices of History, put together by Charles Beard, tonight we inaugurate another annual National Foreign Trade Week. Now there is little use in our talking about and planning for foreign trade unless the outcome of this war is favorable to the peoples of the world. They sure aren't talking about favorable to us, are they, folks, to the, quote, common man? He said, for free trade means free bargaining to mutual advantage, their advantage. To get a more complete picture of what the dangers involve, this is quoting Cordell Hull, he said, it is necessary to envisage the kind of an economic world that would exist if the would-be conquerors were to win. Under it, trade is reduced essentially to barter. And, of course, that to them would be like going back into the cave days, wouldn't it, folks? And it's the most natural way to trade. He said, unhappily, shortly after the close of the First World War, power fell into the hands of groups which advocated political and economic nationalism in their most extreme forms. And do you do understand when they use the word nationalism? They're using it as a terrible, terrible thing. And basically, we might say nationalism is patriotism, couldn't we, folks? Nationalism? In other words, taking care of the people within the particular nation. And that's what he says. Unhappily, shortly after the close of the First World War, power fell into the hands of groups which advocated political and economic nationalism in their most extreme forms. And he was talking about Italy, Japan, and Germany, the three major powers opposing Bolshevism in Europe for all Europeans. Then he goes on, excuse me, knowing these facts as we do, he said, it is none too early to lay down at least some of the principles which policies must be guided at the conclusion of the war. To press for a broad program of world economic reconstruction and to consider tentative plans for application of those policies. The main principles, as proven by experience, are few and simple. 1941 May, listen to this, folks. Number one, he said, extreme nationalism must not again be permitted to express itself in excessive trade restrictions. Number two, non-discrimination in international commercial relations must be the rule so that international trade may grow and prosper. Three, listen now closely to this, because it's dictating to the nations, raw material supplies must be available to all nations without discrimination. Four, international agreements regarding the supply of commodities must be handled as to protect fully the interests of the consuming countries and their people. Yes, of course. And number five, he said the institutions and arrangements of international finance must be so set up that they lend aid to the essential enterprises and the continuous development of all countries, and permit payment through processes of trade consonant with the welfare of all countries. And so today, folks, the U.S., I'm just talking here, not reading, but our trade deficit, not ours, it isn't ours, the U.S. trade deficit is in the hundreds of billions, maybe the trillions of dollars now, I don't know. And of course, China is the most favored nation for trade. And so they've carried out their plan very, very well. And then the last paragraph here, this isn't the entire speech, it was an excerpt from his speech. He says, measures must be taken to give effect to these principles. Measures taken to give effect to these principles must be freely open to every nation which desires a peaceful life in a world at peace and is willing to cooperate in maintaining that peace. Now listen to this again. It's a threat. Measures taken to give effect to these principles must be freely open to every nation which desires a peaceful life in a world at peace and is willing to cooperate in maintaining that peace. And that's end quoting, excerpting Cordell Hull, May of 1941. And that we remember that peace, and their version of peace is total and complete absence of resistance to the Talmudic, Pharisaic plan for world dominion, their world order. We will now excerpt from various writings regarding Adolf Hitler's monetary policy. Now listen to this, folks. For those of you who haven't heard it, I got most of this done about 4 years ago before Chuck passed away, and it's been sitting there. But I did read part of this to our listeners a long time ago on the shortwave. This is from Which Way Western Man by William Gailey Simpson, page 642, the death knell of the entire Jewish money system. He said Hitler began his rule by breaking with the international bankers. He believed that Germany could never be a sovereign and really independent state so long as she had to live on borrowed money. Instead of going to the bankers for money to buy what she had to procure from abroad, she bartered, that is, swapped, some of her surplus to obtain what she needed from the surplus of other nations without debt being incurred on either side. And with this approach, Germany was soon crowding out all competitors. Folks, Germany was a real threat to the international money masters, the banksters. And during all this time that Adolf Hitler was chancellor, until the war, of course, the people in Germany were absolutely thriving, while the rest of the world, or the developed world, we would say, was the people were living on streets and soup lines and whatnot because of the Depression. And to continue with Which Way Western Man, this excerpt, it said that, moreover, for the money required to finance vast programs for a complete regeneration of the life of the German people and for making Germany the most powerful state in Europe, Hitler simply issued what money was needed on the authority of the German government and based it not on gold, of which he had none, but on the productive wealth of the land within German confines, combined with the productivity inherent in German brains and German labor. And it proved sound. It worked. In less than 10 years, Germany became easily the most powerful state in Europe. It worked so magically and magnificently that it sounded the death knell of the entire Jewish money system. World Jewry knew that they had to destroy Hitler's system by whatever means might prove necessary, or their own would necessarily die. And if it died, with it must die their dream and their hope of making themselves masters of the world. The primary issue over which World War II was fought was to determine which money system was to survive. At bottom, it was not a war between Germany and the so-called Allies. Primarily, it was war to the death between Germany and the international money power. And as we said last week, if you remember, Lincoln had issued the greenbacks, and we were told when we were going to school that it was worthless money. And he got killed. And you know, there is, I don't know that this is true, but it has been written that John Wilkes Booth escaped safely over to Europe and was taken very good care of the rest of his life by the Rothschilds. In fact, I had read that John Wilkes Booth was a relation to the Rothschild family. And then, of course, there was John F. Kennedy when he issued the presidential directive, executive order, to have the same kind of state notes written up, printed up. And they were actually paying the military with it. And there were, I think, a few billion dollars printed. And I don't know ever if that executive order was invalidated, voided out, recalled. But as soon as JFK was gone, of course, they quit printing the money and quit competing with the international banksters and their Federal Reserve debt notes. And just remember the whole difference there. When they were paying the military with it, it was being earned into circulation, you see. And that's the same thing that Adolf Hitler did. And now we're going to excerpt from a book titled The World's Troublemakers by Bruce Brown. This was written in 1962. Bruce Brown was a Protestant minister from Australia, and the book is just absolutely, it's one of those little gems. And the chapter, this chapter, is titled Between the Two World Wars. Bruce Brown said, wrote, soon after the peace conference at Versailles in 1919, the international financiers arranged a conference of their own at Brussels in 1920 when they decided to have a gold standard reimposed on all countries and to deflate the currencies. Their stooges throughout the world, with the notable exception of the late Sir Denison Miller, who was then governor of our Commonwealth Bank, that would be Australia, dutifully obeyed at those directions. They decided to have a gold standard reimposed on all countries and to deflate the currencies. Sir Winston Churchill was the stooge in England. In 1925, he introduced the legislation which put the UK back on the gold standard. It's something to think about because I used to believe this too, you know, just because I read it and I didn't actually have any further understanding that, you know, the paper money is worthless without being backed by gold. Well, this paper money is worthless anyway because it's all debt money, folks. But you have to remember who controls the gold. See, and if you're controlling the gold, you're still going to control the economy. So try to follow this and listen to this. Winston Churchill introduced the legislation which put the UK back on the gold standard. This simple episode put £1,000,000,000 into the pockets of the right people and added £750 million to the dead weight of the British national debt to the money masters. It also precipitated the coal strike and accelerated the spread of ruin and poverty in all directions. This was followed by the Depression, previously referred to, and the conditions arising from this prepared the way for the war of 1939. In the early stages of that war, there was what has been called a phony period, in which negotiations were conducted between the foreign offices of Great Britain and Germany. The British Foreign Office promised to cease hostilities if Germany returned to the gold standard. Germany would not agree to this. Subsequently, at the Atlantic Charter Conference, Winston Churchill promised the governor of the Bank of England that Germany would be forced to base its economy on gold after the defeat of Hitler. Now let us read what the same Winston Churchill said in the British House of Commons on 4/21/1932. And it was in 1925, remember, just 7 years earlier, that he introduced the legislation which put the UK back on the gold standard. This was what he said in the British House of Commons in 1932. He said, when I was moved by many arguments and forces in 1925 to return to the gold standard, I was assured by the highest experts that we were anchoring ourselves to reality and stability, and I accepted their advice. But what has happened? We have no reality, no stability. Is the progress of the human race in this age of almost terrifying expansion to be arbitrarily barred and regulated by fortuitous discoveries of gold mines here and there, or by the extent to which we can persuade the existing coiners and hoarders of gold put their hoards into the common stock? Are we to be told that human civilization and society would have been impossible if gold had not happened to be an element in the composition of the globe? These are absurdities, but they are becoming dangerous and deadly absurdities. They have only to be asserted long enough. They have only to be left ungrappled with long enough to endanger that capitalist and credit system upon which the liberties and enjoyments and prosperity, in my belief, of the masses depend. I therefore point to this evil, listen to this, and to the search for the methods of remedying it as the first, the second, and the third of all the problems which should command and rivet our thoughts. So 7 years later, he's saying we have got to do something about this. Now listen to what the protocols say about the gold protocols. Protocol number one, It says, in our day, the power which has replaced that of the rulers who were liberal is the power of gold. And protocol number two, it says, through the press, we have gained the power. This was written, remember, the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, 100 years ago, folks, over 100 years ago now. Through the press, it says, we have gained the power to influence while remaining ourselves in the shade. Thanks to the press, we have got the gold in our hands, notwithstanding that we have had to gather it out of oceans of blood and tears. But it has paid us, though we have sacrificed many of our people. And our people, they refer to their people as the lesser brethren, if they mean nothing. The Jews, people born into that religion, who believe themselves to be Jews, they're used, folks, the same way that Christians are being used today and have been used down through the ages. It's always the elite. Now here's protocol number five regarding gold. It says, and it was said by the prophets that we were chosen by God himself to rule over the whole world. Earth, excuse me. All the wheels of the machinery of all states go by the force of the engine which is in our hands. And that engine of the machinery of states is gold. The science of political economy invented by our learned elders has for long past been giving royal prestige to capital. And I'm just going to remind you, those of you who, that very early on when Alan Watt was on with us, back in 1998 when he started coming on, and I thought it was a wonderful thing. I read Tupper Saucy's book on the miracle, I don't know, Main Street or something like that. But basically what the book did was explain the Constitution, that section in the Constitution that says that no state shall accept anything for legal tender and payment of debt other than coin, gold and silver coin. And in the back of his book, Tupper Saucy had an IOU, and there was evidently a town or some towns where the people were actually giving the IOUs to pay their taxes, for their licenses, etc. And it couldn't be refuted because it is still in the Constitution. And I was talking about that, and I thought it was really great. And Alan said, I said, what do you think about that? And he said, nope. And I said, why? He said, because. You know, because they control the gold. I said, well, it's better than nothing, isn't it, Alan? And he said, no, because you cannot get out of the system, their system, by using their system. And that stopped me up short. Stopped me up short, I'll tell you that, because it made all the sense in the world to me. And when I asked him, okay, what would your solution be then if there's a solution? And Alan said very unemotionally, as Mr. Spocky does, he said, well, when enough people are aware of it and know about it, it'll collapse of itself. Maybe that's so, I don't know. We're going to return to the world's troublemakers here. It looks to me, well, I can start here. Okay, continuing. And Bruce Brown, the author, wrote, for whom did Churchill really stand? He said, I therefore point to this evil and to the search for the methods of remedying it as the first, the second, and the third of all the problems which should command and rivet our thoughts. What does all this mean? What evil influence was at work to cause such a man to do the very thing he knew in his heart he should not be doing? We'll be back right after this, folks.
Thank you. years ahead of the dominant media. FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net, around the world and on satellite. Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188. If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
If you read the history books, the most often asked questions of Southerners was this: why did you fight? And the most often given answer is, because you're here. In other words, the South did not invade the North invaded the South.
Was it the Civil War or War of Federal Aggression? John Weaver sets the record straight in this DVD series on the Civil War from the Old Paths Christian History Conference. Was there a war to set the slaves free? Or was it a war to enslave us all? Get this DVD and judge for yourself. War of Federal Aggression. Get this DVD presentation for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Call 559-781-3773. The truth seems strange only because we've been indoctrinated with a fiction. War of Federal Aggression. Get it today.
Okay, we're back here on this Wednesday, the 31st of January, 2007. And I'm quoting here from a book titled The World's Troublemakers. And he repeated the statement. He said, for whom did Churchill really stand? I thought about this, you know, when I read that, that allegedly what statement that Winston Churchill made, because we know that he was one of the elite. But, you know, I have read a whole lot. I have read that Churchill got himself in debt to the banksters, and that's when he really became their total pawn. Not that he wasn't in the beginning, but maybe he, you know, had some bright idea that he was actually the prime minister. I don't know. Like presidents do, then they get killed. But once they kowtow, well, then they live long lives, don't they? Anyway, Bruce Brown said, for whom did Churchill really stand? When he said that, I therefore point to this evil and to the search for the methods of remedying it, that is, the economic system on a gold-backed standard. He said, search for the methods of remedying it, and the first, the second, and the third of all the problems which should command and rivet our thoughts. And Bruce Brown went on. He said, what does all this mean? What evil influence was at work to cause such a man to do the very thing he knew in his heart he should not be doing? All of us who lived through the First World War, the Worldwide Depression, and the Second World War, were able to see for ourselves that in Sir Winston we had a man far above the ordinary in facility of expression and a great inspirer of effort under war conditions. But when we consider the other side of the human ledger, what do we get? Prior to the Second World War, Churchill was the leader in the attempt to form an anti-Germany party in England and in organizing the Pledge to Poland on behalf of Slavic Jews. It was this latter, apparently, that actually took us into the war. It was, folks. If you go to sweetliberty.org, if you're not there listening to this, you might be listening from First Amendment Radio, go to the section titled How Wars Are Made Behind the Scenes, and you will see the German white paper there, and it shows all of the efforts that were made with Poland to try to come to some agreement. But they couldn't come to some agreements because while Hitler was trying to make agreements with Poland regarding the corridor, the land that was taken, and the corridor that shut them off from part of Germany, East Prussia, then England made a pact with Poland and said, if any country attacks you, then they have attacked us, and we will come to your aid. And that was when the war actually began. And the Poles, the Jews there in Poland, were killing the Germans. They were German people who wound up in Poland after they sliced big chunks of Germany off and created Poland as a country. And so those people that were Germans living in Poland under communist, Jew communist control were being abused and killed. And they were doing it to take Hitler to the very end of his ability to stand it. And then in came England, and that's how it started. I always thought that Adolf Hitler started the war. And then you read that he refused to drop any bombs on England. And as soon as, in fact, it was in May, maybe the 17th, I can't remember the date, that Winston Churchill became a prime minister, on the evening of that day is when England started dropping bombs into Germany. And then, of course, Germany began to retaliate. But up until that time, there was nothing going on. So they pushed and pushed and pushed until there was no choice. So anyway, back here to Bruce Brown's book, The World's Troublemakers. When Hitler had been soundly established, Samuel Untermeyer, a New York Jewish lawyer, called for war on Germany. This call was made through radio station WABC on August 7, 1933. He had just returned from a world conference of Jews. Excuse me, folks. I'm sorry about that. These girls. I'm just going to let them out. I'm so sorry for the interruption, but they're not going to quit. Every time there's a critter out in the yard, they have to go chase it away. And then they'll be scratching at the door in about 3 or 4 minutes, wanting to come back in because it's cold out there. I'm sorry. All right. Now, I'll start that paragraph over. When Hitler had been soundly established, Samuel Untermeyer, a New York Jewish lawyer, called for war on Germany. This call was made through radio station WABC on August 7, 1933. He had just returned from a world conference of Jews at The Hague. In the broadcast, he said he was calling for a holy war. Now, I have a big, huge, large, bold letters here that says this sentence is not finished. I don't know if I stopped and didn't get back to it or what. I want you to know that you will find information on Samuel Untermeyer. I believe it would be in the Greatest Hopes section. And also, that radio broadcast that he did on August 7th was published the very next day in the New York Times, and when I was in St. Louis at one point, Joe Skews, one of our listeners, and I went to the library and went through their archives through the microfilm, and I found the newspaper article, and I transcribed it directly from the New York Post as it was stated. Now, this is another book. I'm going to stop here because I didn't finish that sentence, I'm sorry to say. And the next one we're going to be quoting from is called Citadels of Chaos by Cornelius Wieth on page 266, Killing Hitler's Experiment. Here's what Cornelius Wieth said. He says, Marion Echols, excuse me, of the Federal Reserve Board, and Montague Norman of the Bank of England agreed not later than 1935 on the joint policy of killing Hitler's financial experiment by all methods, including war if necessary. Norman's job was to engineer Hitler into the dilemma of having to reverse his financial policy or commit an act of war. He was to deliver into Hitler's hands a secret ultimatum, which virtually required him to keep the peace and at the same time destroy the trade and employment boom in Germany. The first condition meant that Hitler was not to acquire any real credit across Germany's border except by negotiations approved by Norman. The second meant that he was to put an end to the use of Germany's real credit, except in the principle believed in by Norman and Echols, which, of course, do not utilize the country's real credit to the full at all. And Bruce Brown said, if that statement is true, then it looks as though we have been deliberately misled about Germany by liars and murderers of the type encountered by Jesus. And what was this financial experiment? On page 272, we get the explanation. This is once again quoting back. Now he's quoting from the Citadels of Chaos. Hitler then established a system which began by kicking the international bankers out of office and ended in a happy and prosperous country. So much so that the London Times openly avowed that British financial and economic authorities were staggered by the, quote, miraculous feat of Nazi finance. The London Times openly avowed that British financial and economic authorities were staggered by the miraculous feat of Nazi finance. People wondered why Germany had no difficulty in financing the war, why she did not have to increase taxation, compulsory savings, or issue enormous war loans. Instead, Germany managed to cut taxes during the war. Public savings banks touched new records month after month. Money was so plentiful that interest on state loans was reduced. Remember what I read to you last week from The Coming Battle, where the London Times had made the statement that mischievous financial, I forget how he put it, and I'd have to go back to check it out. Did Molly come in? Oh, there she is. But they said that this country, the U.S., would be able to supply all the money it ever needed for free, and that the country would be wealthy, the people of the country would be wealthy beyond any time in civilized history. So, you know, that statement said to me that ever since we've had this thing called civilization, the money has been the master. And it always seems to be the same cult behind it, doesn't it, folks? So money was so plentiful that in Germany that interest on state loans was reduced. And Bruce Brown, ending that, made a statement. He said, like the rest of us, it must be assumed that the clergy did not know of these things. In their monthly bulletin of December 1940, the Economic Reform Club of London referred to the way in which, for generations, the nation had hung on the words of the great bankers, and then said this. This is the Economic Reform Club of London. It said, the pill is not easy to swallow. Then in our search for economic wisdom, we must turn straight from the Bank of England to Adolf Hitler, not stopping at the London School of Economics. What is the secret of Hitler's financial miracle? The state controls the banks instead of the banks controlling the state. Credit is based on productive capacity, not on debt. It sounds so simple, doesn't it, folks? Thus enabling Hitler to use all the labor, material, and equipment that he has. The prospect is disturbing. Applied to peacetime industries instead of armaments, such a monetary system would result in an overwhelming output of wealth. Used by a democratic state in the interests of the people, there would be nothing to prevent the entire population from having enough to eat and wear. That's end quoting from what was it we were quoting from? The Economic Reform Club of London. That's what they said. Now, in her appendix, in Germany and England, Nesta Webster excerpts from Remarks of Hitler. In his speech of January 30th, 1934, Adolf Hitler said, France fears for her security. No one in Germany wishes to threaten her, and we are ready to do anything in order to prove this to her. And then on March 7th, 1936, he said, for 3 years I have tried slowly but continually to create the foundation of a Franco-German Entente. March 16th, 1936, he said, I have tried to show that the maintenance of the doctrine of the hereditary enemy is and must be unreasonable for the two peoples. In other words, they inherited each other as enemies. There was always this rift going on between France and Germany. I have tried to show that the maintenance of the doctrine of the hereditary enemy is and must be unreasonable for the two peoples. And in the week of the recent crisis, on September 26, 1938, he said, I have affirmed, these are appendices in her book, Germany and England, and you will find that book at tweetliberty.org in our book section, books online, or I believe it's also in How Wars Are Made, Behind the Scenes. And if you haven't read Adolf Hitler's speech that he made that came from the Voices of History, that one book I've quoted from, it's a big old fat book, 700-800 pages, all kinds of speeches and documents in it for that entire year leading up to the war. I was astounded, folks. I was so astounded reading that I transcribed it. It was a pretty long speech. But I learned a lot from listening to it, and it's never been refuted either. All of the countries that sent men to join the German army, the people that came from other countries to join the German army, because they weren't trying to take over Europe or take over the world. They were trying to stop the takeover of Europe and actually the world by the world's troublemakers, as Bruce Brown labels them. And here's what he said on September 26, 1938. That date is my birthday. I've noticed September 26th coming up fairly often in history and certain things. I guess we would notice it, you know, because it's our birthday, but Adolf Hitler said, I have affirmed that the question of Alsace-Lorraine no longer existed for us. We, all of us, do not wish for war with France. We have no claims to formulate with regard to France absolutely none. All territorial differences which existed between France and Germany are eliminated. I see no differences whatever between us. We are two great nations which both wish to work and live, and they will live better if they work together. Now, at least at this point, that part of this chapter is concluded, and I'm quoting here at the end of this chapter because it's the last chapter in part one of Jewish persecution. I said, let us conclude this part one with a few excerpts from Jacques Sapali's book, which we briefly quoted earlier. The book, translated from the French, published in the U.S. in 1991 and already out of print, is titled Millennium, Winners and Losers in the Coming World Order. This is hair-raising, folks. According to Alvin Toffler, who wrote the foreword, his, quote, friend Jacques Sapali is a, quote, product of France's most prestigious Grande École, which is a great school, I guess. That is the elite school where they go to learn to become bureaucrats. Precision-tooled, according to Alvin Toffler, Jacques Sapali, precision-tooled to become a high-level bureaucrat. Atali, those were his words. Atali, a member of the Bilderberger Group, is, or was in 1991, now, quote, presiding over a $12 billion bank that could turn out to be a pillar of the new global order, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development in London. From 1981 to 91, that would be 10 years, Atali, as special advisor to Communist French President François Mitterrand, accompanied Mitterrand at meetings with world leaders, and this is a quote, whispering ideas and helping to introduce Mitterrand to the 21st century. So you see, it's as Alan told us, number one is never number one, it's always number two that's number one. And it's these, quote, advisors behind the president. And can't you just see that? Him whispering ideas, sitting in meetings, all these world meetings, with François Mitterrand. This gives a good clue as to who really ruled France and who really rules all nations today. Puppet rulers picked and placed by the money masters, controlled by their special advisors. Here's Atali's thumbnail sketch of the winners and losers in the coming world order. This is excerpted. And we must admit he seems to be in a position to know. Here's some excerpts from his book. He said, future shock is yesterday. Change is the only constant in a world of upheaval. A new order is being born. In the next millennium, we're in it, folks, aren't we? Humanity's fate will be shaped by a new set of winners and losers. Here's another one. Japan and Europe may supplant the U.S. as the chief superpowers wrangling for global economic supremacy. Well, there's no wrangling. They just pretend they're wrangling, folks. He said, from their privileged technological perches, they will preside over a world that has embraced a common ideology of consumerism, but is bitterly divided between rich and poor. A common ideology of consumerism. Isn't that pathetic? Shop till you drop. Then he said, severed from any national allegiance or family ties, the consumer citizen of the world's privileged regions will become rich nomads. The consumer citizens of the world's privileged regions will become rich nomads. He said they will roam the planet seeking ways to use their free time, shopping for information, sensations, and goods that only they can afford, while yearning for human fellowship and the certitudes of home and community that no longer exist. because their functions have become obsolete. That's a mouthful. Yearning for human fellowship and the certitudes of home and community that no longer exist because their functions have become obsolete. Like New Yorkers, here's another one, like New Yorkers who every day face homeless beggars who loiter around automated teller machines pleading for spare change, these wealthy wanderers will everywhere be confronted by roving masses of poor nomads, boat people on a planetary scale, seeking to escape from the destitute periphery where most of the Earth's population will continue to live. Most of the Earth's population is planned to live on the periphery of the wealthy folks. This book gives me creeps. It gives me chills. He said these impoverished migrants will ply the planet searching for sustenance and shelter. They will live the life of the living dead. That's what they have in store for us. That's what they hope for. And I'll read a few more here because we've got a couple of more minutes. Paul Kennedy, author of The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, argues that the impressive projection of massive American military force halfway across the world blurs rather than illuminates the larger question of America's real position as a fading hegemonic power. He compares America's deployment to Spain's decision in 1634 to send its powerful army to defend its beleaguered Habsburg cousins during the Thirty Years' War. He compares America's deployment. No other European nation at the time could equal such force projection. Yet, the Spanish monarchy was sagging under massive debt and inefficient industries dependent upon foreign manufacturers and beholden to special interests at home. Despite the glittering display of its armed might, by the 1640s, the suspension of interest payments and declarations of bankruptcy by the Spanish kings fully revealed the decline of Spanish power. And then I would ask, to whom were the Spanish kings in debt? You know, that was one of the things, folks, before I knew about the Federal Reserve Bank not being federal and having no reserves. I would hear on the news the debt, and I would think, who in the world could we be in debt to, because we send money all over the world? And I wonder how many people ask that question. Who is the debt to? Anyway, we're done with this. We're not done, but I'm going to finish it here because the rest of it is just finishing up, and I won't come back to this next week. I don't know what we'll do next week, but we'll do something. Maybe have a guest with us. And I hope that you are keeping warm, and I hope that somehow you are able, folks, to find some peace in the chaos and the evil that is in this world. Sometimes it makes me cry, sometimes I get nauseous, and sometimes I just take myself away from it for a little while. And I hope you can do that. I will see you next Wednesday evening. Till then, have a lovely week. Spend time with your loved ones. Nothing more important than the world. Good night, folks. Good night, dear.
You are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. We do not have freedom of speech because the Constitution gives it to us. The constitutional amendment was written to keep the government from taking our freedom away. The Creator gave us our rights, but He also gives us the